Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and start with a couple of announcements. We are not going to work House Bill 2361 today, and we are holding over House Bill 2345 until at least the 8th of April, or maybe a different day. We've got some amendments that haven't showed up, but we will not do it today. We'll see when the amendments come. So those are off today. Is everybody here? Okay. I'll make a couple of other announcements when we get the rest of the committee. So we intend to move today an amendment and the bill for 2059 and an amendment and the bill for 2435. We'll do those in work sessions. We'll have a couple of people, at least one, to testify on at least one of those bills. Then we'll open up a public hearing on 2728, and I'll talk a little bit about scheduling issues on 2009 to give you a sense of where that is, but I'd prefer to wait until we get a couple more folks. So I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2059. And Representative Garrett, is that your workforce?
That is.
Would you please talk to us about it?
Yes, I'd love to. This came before us for a first hearing many weeks ago. It's a bill that relates to...
Excuse me just a moment. Could you hold on a moment?
Aaron, this is Sandy with the House Healthcare Committee.
Hi there.
Hi, the chair's just gaveled in on House Bill 2059. If you just and you are live.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this bill came before us in its original form, required licensees of a health licensing board to report prohibited conduct to of another licensee of a different board, and there was, I think, a lot of interest in the concept, but also agreement that the language was flawed in the original drafting, and so you asked a work group to look into the matter. We convened a group of several advocate organizations and licensing boards to hash this out. It took extensive work, a number of sessions. It's a complicated area of the law. We're dealing with licensing boards and their own rules as well as state statute. And it took a lot of sorting out, but after several meetings and a lot of email discussion, I think we've been able to come up with an end result that goes farther than some would have preferred and doesn't go as far as others might have preferred, but is at least acceptable to all involved. And I think for the details of the amendments, maybe Sandy was prepared to walk through them.
Sandy, are you prepared to walk through the dash for us? I was about to send Sandy off.
I sent your another staff person off.
Okay,
sure.
Great.
Thank you, Representative Garrett. House Bill 2059, you can either refer to the dash for amendments or the hand and gross version of the bill. The very first change on the amendment, we are adding the emergency medical text to the list of boards to be included in the bill. The second component of the amendment is on basically begins on page 2, where we define prohibited conduct. There are two areas there. We also define the work group, or the amendment defines unprofessional conduct. Subsection 2, which is located in the middle of page 2 of the hand and gross and page 1 of the amendment, is the first reference to language that maintains compliance with federal and state confidentiality laws. And subsection 2 also is where the substance of requiring licensees to report other licensees to the board within, well, there's qualifiers around that, without undue delay, but in no event more than 10 working days for that reporting requirement. Subsection 3 is the self-reporting language for licensees to self-report. Subsection 4 is where the licensee directs the board to conduct the investigation on the licensee, again, without undue delay and no later than 10 working days. It also specifies that the board presents a report, I believe, shall present the facts to... the board then is required to report it to the appropriate law enforcement agency. Subsection 5 is the enforcement mechanism. In other words, it... my notes just reflect that it's the enforcement mechanism for self-reporting. Subsection C is the actual violation of that lack of reporting as a Class A violation. Subsection 7 was also on the self-reporting, but it doesn't include peer review reporting, I believe, is what that one was. Mm-hmm. Are you... Okay. I apologize, Mr. Chair. I'm on sub 8. Representative Garrett.
Yeah, I can help you with that.
Thank you.
A couple of the issues that I think were the hardest to work out were self-reporting of criminal conduct, and we went around and around on that and agreed that we would require licensees to self-report certain conduct as described in subsection 3, a misdemeanor or felony conviction or an arrest for a felony crime must be self-reported. And in exchange for that, what we say in subsection 8 is that that is the only thing that is required to be self-reported, except that boards may go beyond that in the context of applications and renewals. Many of them already do so. In that context, they're permitted to do whatever they're doing now or go beyond.
That's what 9 says, is the latter part.
No, that's what 8 says.
Yeah, but 9 also says that no other obligation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, subsection 9 is in reference to the mandatory reporting requirements that some professionals are already held to, a.k.a. the child abuse. This says they still have to do both, is what sub 9 does. Subsection 10 is the immunity for people that report. And that is the substance of the changes in the bill. The rest of the amendments are that conforming confidentiality language inserted to all of the appropriate licensing boards that are contained in this bill. And let me just double check, make sure I don't have... Right, that I have no more notes on here. And if you want more detail or further explanation, I can always call Legislative Council.
No, I think that's right. Representative Garrett, will you... May I finish up talking about how where the members of your work group are in respect to the bill?
Yes. The Oregon Medical Association had a number of concerns about the original bill. I think we have accommodated a lot of those, and OMA has also, to its credit, come a good distance to a position of ultimate neutrality on the bill, and they're not going to oppose it. Both the Oregon Board of Nursing and the Medical Board are in agreement with the amendments. Who else am I missing? We've also worked with the Governor's Office, and they are in agreement with the final product as well.
Mr. Bishop wants to make a comment on this bill. Is that right?
And there are some questions to your
question
right.
Question here? Yep. Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps Representative Garrett might explain why we limit in Section 8, you referred to it already, Subsection 8, the ability of the board to require reporting, self-reporting, if I understood you correctly. There's a sort of, we sort of preempt the boards from saying you have to self-report a misdemeanor, for instance, if I understood you correctly.
They would not be able to require self-reporting of a misdemeanor arrest. Misdemeanor conviction would be reportable. The reason for this result, it's a product of compromise. The purpose of this bill and other bills we're looking at is to achieve more standardization across the licensing boards in how these issues are addressed. And as a product of the negotiations, in exchange for requiring licensees to self-report certain conduct, we did preempt boards from going beyond that. And that was just a policy outcome that...
Are there any boards that are... Will this have an effect on current practice of any boards? A limiting effect?
The only... Ms. Mercer might want to talk about that. I am aware that the medical board has been in a rulemaking process. And initially... I understood that they had a concern about this, but I've been informed that they are now, this is acceptable to them.
Okay, and then my other question is about reporting, it's about confidentiality, and these references, ORS 676.175 and 676.177, the disclosure, the statutes pertaining to disclosure, do you or Sandy know... Can you tell us what, or can someone tell us what would be disclosed and what would be confidential?
I believe 177 is the statute that allows a board to share information with another board. Is that correct? Yeah. So this just clarifies that the confidentiality does not preclude a board from disclosing information to the licensing board of the person that may be under investigation. That would defeat the purpose of the bill.
Okay. I may want to follow up on that, but I'm good for now.
Thank you.
Can I?
Yes.
Representative Garrett, thank you for your work. Under subsection 2, can you give me an example of where state or federal confidentiality laws prohibit someone from reporting prohibited conduct?
What we're trying to get at here is to ensure that a licensee, for example, a psychiatrist or psychologist, who learns information in the context of a privileged relationship from a patient would not be required by this bill to report that conduct to the licensing board. Our policy objective is to preserve all privileged conversations that currently exist and not intrude on those privileges.
Here's just a moment. Could we get somebody who's got a BlackBerry going off to shut off, as I heard Representative Tomei say this morning, a BlackBerry or a Blueberry or any of those things?
Raspberry.
It's interfering with
And one specific example, Representative Maurer, that we discussed at great length was the peer review privilege that exists under Oregon law and the laws of many other states.
Okay.
We want to be sure that privileged relationship is protected.
It's protected.
It's vital, and we did not want this bill to be construed to invade that relationship.
There's also one we've been working on the other bill is the prevention of disclosing information out of substance abuse treatment programs.
Well, that was
a federal law that has...
Federal.
But this talks about both federal statutes, I think.
Correct. Okay. And it doesn't specifically mention the peer review statute, but we do want to note for the record that peer review is one of the protections that would be encompassed within state and federal confidentiality laws.
Mr. Bishop, do you have a comment on it? Thank you for your help in this. We do appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of Northwest Permanente and Kaiser Permanente's Northwest region on behalf with regard to House Bill 2059. I apologize that I'm congested today, but it's a condition I brought into the building, not one that I acquired here.
Try not to leave any of it here.
Take it with you.
We do appreciate the work of the work group, Representative Garrett and Kennemer, as well as staff in putting together hand-engrossed versions to help us understand what the amendments do. This bill accomplishes some very important purposes, and it intends to standardize across all health professional licensing boards reporting requirements with regard to prohibited conduct and unprofessional conduct. Prohibited conduct is a new requirement of the law, and it was a very well-developed and discussed provision, as Representative Garrett indicated. We agree with virtually all of the Dash 4 amendments. There is one possible glitch that I'm concerned about in subsection 9, where it reads, the obligations imposed by this section are in addition to and not in lieu of other obligations to report prohibited and or unprofessional conduct provided by law. I believe that provided by law phrase includes rulemaking, and this provision could be read to allow the boards to define by rule what constitutes prohibited conduct. That's something we've tried to avoid in order to standardize the practices across the board, across all of the boards, so that everybody is complying with the same requirements about what's required to be reported. I think the work group was agreed that we didn't want variation across the boards, and I'm just concerned that this language may encourage the boards to adopt their own interpretations of what prohibited conduct is, even though the law is defining it. I've talked with Representative Garrett about this. He believes that that would be going well beyond what he understood this provision to do, and I appreciate that interpretation, but our whole goal in this bill was to accomplish standardization, and if this provision authorizes something other than that, then the bill's purpose will be frustrated, and the goal of having a well-understood reporting standard will not be accomplished.
Bruce, do you have any experience that brings that forth, Bruce, the by law thing? I mean, the sense that by law might also mean by administrative rule?
I think there's no question that when an agency adopts a rule, it has the force of law, and that when you say by law, it is not limited to statute. It would encompass rulemaking that's adopted by boards, too. I have not checked that with the Attorney General's office. Welcome to do that, but I think standard practice is that by law would be anything that is lawfully allowed.
You feel more comfortable with that said by statute?
Mr. Chair, I'd feel more comfortable if it said as defined in this section.
It says in lieu of other obligations, which obviously means in addition to this section.
And there are a number of boards, I think, that have definitions of what constitutes unprofessional conduct. It's the prohibited conduct I'm specifically addressing because that's a new term that's being defined here just for the purposes of this bill.
Mr. Bishop, thank you. Why don't we note your objection, put that on the record, make clear on the record that the intent is that it not be by administrative rule, and then perhaps when this gets to the Senate, you might propose an amendment that would clean up that little potential glitch with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Does that sound all right to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Does anybody know where our other vice chair is? Oh, and we haven't had an answer back from the speaker?
Yes, we just got one, Mr. Chair.
What was the answer? We stand at ease for a moment. I'm sorry, I should not. Let's go back to work. First, let's have a motion on the Dash 4 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2059 dated March 31st, 2009.
Is there any objection to the Dash 4s? Any discussion? First, any objection? Okay, the Dash 4s are now in.
Mr. Chair?
Reverse Cannon, have you had enough time? I noticed you.
I did.
You were shuffling through.
I got what I needed by looking up the reference.
Okay.
Let's go.
Is there a withdrawal? No, it doesn't need to be withdrawn. I need to go on the record.
Okay. To move it. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2059 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion from Representative, from my good Vice Chair, Representative Maurer, to move House Bill 2059 as amended with the Dash 4s to the House with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that? We have an indeterminate fiscal. We've just checked with the Speaker's office. It says in the fiscal, the fiscal impact of this bill is indeterminate. The Health-Related Regulatory Board's estimate this bill could have a fiscal impact depending on the number of reports that are received and the number of additional hours of investigative work and additional compliance hearings that could result. Individual boards may need to seek additional expenditure limitation from the legislature or e-board if there is a significant workload impact in the bill. We've been asked to put on the record, we do expect this to be minimal. We don't expect this to create a huge flood of new work for any of the boards, and having put that on the record, we'll hope it's true, we are not required to move this to Ways and Means. So I'll open the floor for discussion on the motion to move 2059. I also want to say, Representative Garrett and the other folks on the work of Representative Kemener, you guys did a great job getting this difficult process together. Representative Kotek?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. Again, I agree. I think Representative Garrett has done a wonderful job and appreciate the members of the work group. And if we recall, we've been having this discussion since the interim, and I just want to clarify the goal of the legislation. While we want to have standardization, the goal is to protect the public from unprofessional conduct
exactly
from health
it.
Practitioners. That's what we're trying to achieve, and I think we're getting this really moves us down the road, and I really appreciate your work on that.
I think I neglected to actually remind everybody that was the intent of the bill.
That is the intent, but the additional intent, which is also a very important intent, is to make it clear to professionals what their obligation is when they deal with difficult situations where they believe other professionals are behaving in a non-professional or even an illegal way. So it is an important protection of the public, we think, but it also, I think, helps people deal with the problems that they face with, including several of the ones we heard. Representative Bruce.
Just a quick question. How would this information, once it gets to the process, how is information conveyed to licensees? Is there a newsletter? How is information like this generally conveyed to existing licensees?
The information as a result of?
Passage of this.
Well,
the passage
this will trigger investigations.
I think what he's asking is how will that find out about
you have licensees that aren't, and I realize, you know, ignorance of the law is never an excuse to not obey the law, usually. But how? I mean, is there a newsletter? I mean, how is this information put to them?
I think we leave this up to the obligation, in this case, both of the professional associations and of the boards to inform their members and their licensees that this has passed, and it enhances their obligation, and I would assume it would be a part of their both. We would ask as a part of their routine communication to make this information.
And I would assume there's a routine method to do that. I don't know what it. We hadn't had any discussion.
I see some head shaking.
Routine.
I expect it's not for everybody, but it is for some, and it would be useful to ask others within earshot that this happened.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're correct. Professional boards have an obligation to extend education to their enrollees, and they send out, I think all of the boards, without exception, send out essentially a newsletter after the session to inform their people, and then most all professional associations duplicate that with their newsletters. So for most professionals, there's more than adequate notice.
Representative Thompson?
Well, just on Taylor, what he said, that's true. The Board of Pharmacy, issues a regular newsletter with any regulatory updates in it, and then those same issues are covered during continuing education training sessions with Board of Pharmacy or Oregon Law updates for professionals. And I know a number of the other boards do that. I can't speak for all of them, but I think that's a pretty standard practice. So I wouldn't worry about the information getting out in a timely manner.
Okay, thank you. Are we prepared to vote?
Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair
Greenlee? Aye. Motion passes. Let's see. I assume this is a consent calendar item. Or just in case not, perhaps Representative Garrett, would you be prepared to carry it on?
Why not? No good deed goes unpunished.
That's it. No good deed goes unpunished. Exactly. Thank you very much. I'm about to open up a work session on House Bill 2438. And invite Representative Benz to the group. But just before I do, 2435, I'm sorry, 2435. But just before I do, I want to share, please come up. I'm sorry that I've held you this long. It's not fine. It's rude, and I apologize. I do want to give you a sense of the schedule for 2009 and where we're going with that, because the rubber has instantly hit the road. We will have back, we hope, by 5 p.m. Friday, what I guess is the Dash 1 amendments. Have you heard of any other amendments to 209?
I have not, Mr. Chair.
It'll be a Dash N amendment, which will be probably the longest amendment that we will have to deal with. It's 650 pages at last count. It is a gut and stuff, and it has been reorganized so that the first 25 or 26 pages are all the substance, and everything beyond that, we'll let you know what those pages are, so you just need to copy those pages. Everything after, I think maybe up to page 30, I'm not sure exactly what that number is conforming amendments that, and we're going to go through those and make sure that's really true, that there's no... I just lost Representative Kotek. 600 number scared her off. We'll share this information with her. That's gonna we'll distribute it to you on Monday. My intention is on Wednesday to adopt those amendments, which will produce the A enrolled version of the bill. And as I say, that would. My intention is to adopt those on Wednesday, which is the 8th. We're going to try and prepare a minimum number of amendments from that point on, and we'll need to work those very quickly. Representative Dembrough is working on some workforce things. I'd like to, whatever we want to do with that, combine it into a single one. Representative Kotek's working on some cost-saving proposals. We'll try and get that in. And I'll ask Representative Harker to sort of work on some ones where we're dealing with the health home, the primary care, reimbursement, whatever those are. There is a bill that I think has reached the consensus in the Senate on that, which means everybody around hates it equally, so that it might be acceptable to pass. And I think most of the problem is around the name of it, but I would like to have those to put in. We'll probably put in three Senate bills they're working on, Pulsed, all claims, all payer database, and I think something on workforce, and I think there's one other one they're working on. So between Wednesday the 8th and the night meeting on the 14th or the day meeting on the 15th, I'd like to have all those amendments prepared. And I would hope to include those amendments and pass the bill on the 15th. That's my current objective, is to work that bill. either the night of the 14th or the day of the 15th, depending on who's going to be able to be here on the 14th. If it turns out there are a large number of people who won't be here, we'll move the 15th agenda to the 14th and leave a whole 2 hours to do that. The decision has not been made yet whether we'll be working with the tax in the House Bill 2009 or out of the House Bill 2009. We issued a new agenda for Monday. Is that right? We've issued that new agenda for Monday.
Yes, we have.
Which has on it a public hearing and possible work session for House Bill 2116, which will be the vehicle for the tax that we'll use if we split the tax off. So we want to have that first public hearing. It'll probably, I'm trying to get word whether I can do a tap-tap on it, which for the newer members means we open up a hearing and close it, just leave it open long enough to have met the 72-hour announcements of public meeting requirements. As I've said before, the decision of whether the tax is in 2009 or out is happening above my pay grade, so we'll find out how that's going to work. But the hope is still to have the whole package to revenue by the 20th of April, including the tax component in one vehicle or the other. So that's just so you know what's coming. Remember, when you get 600, anybody else listening to this, when you get a 600-page dash one amendment, we'll ask first how far the substance goes. I've been assured by alleged counsel that it's less than the first 20 pages, the last 30 pages. So please save your printer enough time. We'll make sure there's no substantive amendments in anything beyond that first section, and that's the way it's been. It's been designed by the LC. Okay? Any questions we'll take offline. Open up a work session on House Bill 2435.
Aaron?
I'm checking out.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
And ask Representative Benz to comment on this. And who's had this work group? Is that you?
Yes.
As soon as Representative comments, perhaps you can give us a report on it, where we are. I've been holding him long enough. And
yes.
Does Representative Roblin want to join us?
He's chairing
a meeting, chairing rules.
Where I was.
Okay, sir. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cliff Benz. I'm state representative from District 60, which is Malheur, Harney, Baker, and part of Grant Counties. Before you this afternoon in support of the Dash 3 amendments of House Bill 2435. And just to refresh everyone's memory, the reason for this bill and the reason I introduced a bill similar to this and then found that, oddly enough, there were two bills, so I decided to support your bill, Mr. Chair, and Representative Roblin's, is because in our smaller communities we find that physicians are reluctant to locate in smaller communities, and when we are fortunate enough to attract one that is interested, we want to move quickly before they change their mind. And we find that any delay sometimes gives other more wealthy communities, such as Portland, opportunities to zoom in and steal our perfectly good physicians from us. And we looked at this situation as I represented the hospital in Ontario for many years and worked with the board trying to streamline processes, and it never quite worked out. So that's why we're here today. After our last meeting in our work group, as I'm sure Vice Chair Harker will point out, we've added some additional requirements, which I think help. I do want to say a couple of things, though, about comments I received from physicians about this bill. One of the comments I heard from some of my very good friends, surgeons in Ontario, was that they were feeling that as rural physicians they were second class, and I want to assure everyone that it's not the intent of this bill to in any way suggest that those folks that choose to practice in rural Oregon are second rate or of lesser quality than any other physician any place else. The reason we're asking for this bill is because there are great challenges to doctors that choose to practice out in the rural area. Hardly any backup for call, and very, very difficult many times work for less money. And so I view those who choose that life as people to be congratulated and supported. And the last message
special
I
want...
Special
people.
They are special people. And the last message I want to send is that this rural label that's put on them in any way suggests that they are less than the best that we would find in any larger city. I think I also want to mention that this has a sunset on it in 2 years. January 2nd of 2012. Mm-hmm. So if the board is successful in streamlining its operation, then, of course, this bill will go away, and we won't be bothered by it, and they won't be bothered by it any longer. If, indeed, they are unsuccessful, then we can revisit the sunset sometime after it terminates. I think that the protections that are placed in the bill are adequate for the balance between patient safety on the one hand and the need for rapidity in the review of their credentials on the other. And there is going to be a bit of a trade-off, but it's a very small one. And as we heard last time, I believe there was a mention out of the 1,000 doctors that were reviewed, 5 or 6 were red flagged. And if we view how few doctors are going to locate in rural areas, that small number becomes minuscule. So I would hope that you folks could support this bill, and it would do, I think, good things for our rural communities.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions, Representative Benz? I'd like to hang in a few minutes while we move this out.
Thank you.
Sir, would you work us through the process and the amendments?
I can ask my question for Representative Burke after he's presented.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we had, I think everyone was here for the hearing that we had however long ago, and we decided to have a work group on it. Present at the work group were representatives, I think, of most of the groups present, or most of the groups that were concerned, and there was a lot of discussion about the weighing the costs and benefits, if you will, the need to protect public safety and the need to simultaneously deliver health care to these rural areas. And many of us went to the on the Southern Oregon road trip with Representative Maurer a little while ago and heard directly from people there about the challenges of getting physicians to serve in those areas. We made some compromises in this bill where we extended, I believe, from 60 days to 90 days the duration of the temporary license, and we put into place a criminal history check done via a fingerprint. And following that conversation, amendments were drawn up, sent out for comment, and inserted into the draft, the hand engrossed version. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so
you also gave the board 14 days instead of 7 days?
Correct. Sorry. You gave the board 14 days instead of 7. And there were two additional sections added, Section 2 and Section 3, which do impart sunset practice in January 2nd of 2012, as Representative Bent said. Pardon? All right, and required is in Section 2 that the medical board shall report to us by the end of January 2011 on the issuance of limited licenses to practice medicine at qualifying practice sites so that we can assess the impact of this bill, should it pass, and decide if it should be extended or permitted to sunset, as described in the bill here.
Representative Ken.
Yeah, thank you, and I really appreciate the effort to try to find that balance. A couple of questions. One, if I read this amendment correctly, and I think it was in the original version of the bill as well, a physician would be able to reapply for a limited license. So if their full application, their unrestricted license, had not been granted, perhaps because their application wasn't complete, their materials weren't in order, within that original 90 days, they could be granted another license. And there appears to be no limit on the number of times, if I read this correctly, that somebody could be re-granted a limited license. Is that your understanding as well?
That is my understanding, Representative Cannon. However, there was expressed in the discussion I don't want to put words in the mouth of the board, but confidence in that there would not be many extensions required at all, that once the application got to this point, it could be approved or disapproved for full licensure.
I'd be interested maybe in hearing a little more about that, since it was my impression from our first hearing that one of the things that holds up the granting of a full unrestricted license very often is the inability or perhaps unwillingness of the applicant to pull together all the materials required, and they were numerous for a full license, including records from various colleges, universities, and previous practice sites, right? It's a lot of information to pull together for an unlimited license. That can take months and months and months. I'm just mildly concerned that we create the possibility for a unscrupulous practitioner to sort of draw out the process, keep a limited license, keep, getting that 90-day period reapplied, mm-hmm. and be practicing and potentially they shouldn't. I have some discomfort with proceeding with this bill. I'm prepared to vote for it today, reserving my right to sort of reconsider as I think about it between now and the point it comes to the floor.
Turns out we're not going to be able to work it today.
Oh, well.
You can.
Shall I? Let me attempt to address that with one other point. The criminal background check we thought would expedite the identification of anyone who did have an unscrupulous past, or most of them. And once again, out of the numbers that we heard, were 5 or 6 out of 1,000 applicants. I don't know.
Mr. Maurer? There's a Moon and there's a Thompson.
So this bill, this law, would not go into effect until January 1st of 2010. And the board would have to report back to us in 395 days. Would that be enough time to have enough experience, to have a real feel for the implementation of this? I'm asking you somewhat rhetorically, not expecting you to know the answer. But, I mean, did that, because that's a pretty short window.
It is, and I don't recall this being discussed in the work session. There were several issues that were identified, and we struck bargains, I felt, on them. This is not one that I recall being discussed. If there's anyone in the room who feels otherwise, I'm sure they'll chime in.
Is that Bruin?
Yeah, this is a question for maybe Sandy, or maybe even LC question. Sorry, Sandy, not that. I may absolutely be seeing this incorrectly. Section 3 is the sunset section.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell, it only sunsets Section 2, and Section 2 is only the part where it says the Oregon Medical Board shall report back. It's not the section that actually is the, unless I'm seeing that wrong.
That's true. But it was the original section.
Yeah, it's the old Section 2 is what it's referencing, which is not Section
1. Am I seeing that wrong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I can't answer that question.
Mm.
Since we're not working it today, we'll make sure we get that clarified and perhaps get an amendment to deal with it. Who has the original bill? Somebody have the original bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
There was no Section 2 in the original bill.
There was no Section 2?
No, and
well,
Representative Bruin.
The board by rule shall prescribe the types and limitations upon license issued under this.
No, that's the subsection.
I think the amendment's fine. It's the hand engrossing.
Where's the amendment? Here's the original amendment.
Well, the amendment says the same thing. The dash four says it deletes section two and section
the dash
two.
Three.
We're looking at the dash three.
The dash three.
Sorry.
It says the same thing, though.
Right, but
so section two of this amendment is repealed. Okay, we'll find that out.
Okay.
Sandy will. Representative Thompson.
In the wording of this bill, is there anything that requires the board to grant an additional 90-day extension repeatedly? They may, but do they have to? I mean, we face the question a different way. It's my understanding that they didn't have to do that the way I read it. And if an applicant were dragging their feet and just failing to fulfill the requirements of the application, at some point the board could say, we're not going to put up with this any longer. You didn't get your paperwork in. It's over. Which would be, most of the testimony seemed to be a problem with board managing information. But in the event that an applicant did stall, would it be reasonable that the board would just say, you're not going to get another 90 days?
I read it the same way as you do.
Yeah.
It says not may. Shall. It says may.
Yeah, it doesn't make it automatic. Okay. That may ease that portion of it a little bit. I wouldn't want a automatic rotating forever. But.
Mr. Kenimer?
Just wondered, in light of the issue and the shortness of time that Representative Maurer mentioned, is an emergency clause appropriate so that it takes place sooner than January 1?
What do you think, Mr. Vice Chair?
I'm not a fan of the emergency
clause. No, I'm not either.
But I would suggest that maybe an earlier implementation date might be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
To set a date of 1 July or upon passage of this act.
Upon passage?
90 days after the act.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to even get on the soapbox about the emergency clause, but the point is, if you want it earlier, then just pick the darn date and
pick
say you want
yes.
it started.
Okay. But I think we're going to need to get at least that Section 2 thing amended. We can add this as a date. And Representative Harker, what would you think would be an appropriate effective date? I think we need to give them a little time to get the processes ready.
I think we do. 90 days.
I've heard
thrown
days.
Out 90 days.
Yeah.
1 September.
Okay. Is there a representative of the board here today? Would you join us? Could I ask a question or a favor of you? We don't have a fiscal before us, so because the board has not responded to LFO's request for a fiscal. Could you help get a fiscal for this so we can...
Yikes.
No,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim representing the Oregon Medical Board. Yes, of course, I will pass that on.
Thank you. I very much appreciate that.
Is that your question?
That's the question.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Why don't we include the dash three amendments in the bill? We do that today. Then we can get a hand engrossed version of it.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments be.
Should we get a dash five that includes the dash threes? Would that be better?
Mr. Chair, I would recommend doing that so that all the changes, rather than us working off of yet again another amended bill.
Good.
So
thank you. I can see in your eyes.
Yeah, thank you. were they twirling around?
Yeah.
To do the work.
Okay. Well, then we won't do that now. And again, thank you all for your work, including the board and others that have been involved in this. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2435 and await a new set of amendments and a fiscal to find out whether we need to. You might also comment that I hope it's not a very big fiscal.
Did that help when you make those comments?
After I close the work session, I propose my hope that it won't be a very large fiscal. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2728 and ask if Representative Kotek would kick us off on this one.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just do a little time. She stepped out for just a couple of minutes.
Okay. Well, you tell us what it's about then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2728 is Representative Kotek's bill. This is creating a new category of medical assistance for individuals under 21 years of age, basically folks that are 18 that were in foster care. It requires the Department of Human Services to make application for implementing an amendment to our state plan to include foster care children to continue receiving medical assistance after the age of 18. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And they do cover foster children in Medicaid.
Correct.
When they're up to their 19th birthday.
Correct.
Okay, why don't we... Oh, you don't need to stand at ease?
I know if I went to the restroom.
You're up. You can do it from here or there, whichever is your preference.
Oh, no. Thank you.
Are there other people signed up for this?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Oh, good. And we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 folks, including a DHS representative.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Colleagues, thank you for the opportunity today to talk about House Bill 2728. Because I think this is important, I'm going to read my testimony because I'm a little tired today. Foster care is an important service that the state provides to ensure that our most vulnerable young people are provided with safe and stable homes. When we as the state take over the care and protection of a child through foster care, we assume the duties of a parent to care for that child. Often upon their children reaching young adulthood, parents provide them help in getting health insurance while they transition to college or a job. Since the state acts as the parent for foster youth, we have a duty to do our best to provide health coverage to youth as they age out of the foster care system. This duty has been recognized by many people here in Oregon and across the country. In 1999, federal legislation was passed that allowed states to pursue a Medicaid waiver to ensure children who age out of foster care. Senator Chaffee of Rhode Island was instrumental in getting this legislation passed, hence it is called the Chaffee Waiver. Since then, 22 other states have elected to engage this option and provide insurance for these young adults. Now is the time for Oregon to become one of those states. Essentially, the waiver allows us to provide Medicaid match for this category if we make children aging out of foster care categorically eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. So extending the Oregon Health Plan to youth aging out of foster care by using the Chaffee option is doable, and it's the right thing to do. Other states report that the cost to the state is less than $350 per enrollee per month. Last year in Oregon, 387 children aged out of foster care. Nationally, a third of children who age out of foster care have no other insurance. This extension of coverage is an important element in providing smarter health care for Oregonians. If we cover these young adults who otherwise would not have health insurance, then we can reduce the cost of health care for all other Oregonians as well. Without this extension, we will continue to leave young adults who have depended on us literally out in the cold. One-fifth of young adults who age out of foster care experience a period of homelessness. One-third of them experience significant mental health issues such as post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and alcohol and substance abuse. They are also twice as likely to have a child at a young age and a third more likely to be arrested. A quarter of them are characterized as food insecure. Colleagues, we spend a lot of time, energy, and money taking care of children in the foster care system. It seems only the right and smart thing to do is when they age out of the system to maintain a transition, and one of those bridges is to provide health insurance coverage to make sure that they are on their way to being successful adults. Children who have aged out of foster care need our help to successfully transition away from state's care. If we lessen this sharp transition, we can address some of the major issues that arise. If we pay for some of these costs up front, we can avoid paying significantly larger costs some of these young adults will end up facing. This bill will help former foster youth who do not have health insurance become successful adults and will eliminate one of the most significant barriers to their long-term success. I want to thank you for your time and consideration. We will be hearing from some foster youth as well as the department. I think this is a manageable cost. This is a waiver that we should have pursued years ago, but we might have an opportunity to do now if we have additional dollars in the for expansion of the health plan, and I urge your support of this bill. And in lieu of taking questions, I would say we'd move on to the rest, who are probably more expert on this topic. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you,
Just a very brief question. I did a quick horseback estimate on what you said. My estimate is it comes something like $5 million a year total funds. Is that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee,
300 or 400.
I do not have a fiscal. I think it depends, and I'd have to look back and see how it was written. But it creates a categorical eligible population. There's a chance that some of those folks coming out of the system can get coverage. And I think, you know, depending on, that's a fairly inexpensive population to cover normally. So I actually don't know what the cost would be.
$350 seems awful.
Right. Seems high for that for an adolescent population.
Well, considering our child population for the health plan, what do we estimate now? About $150, $165. I think if you look at other states, they probably have higher costs because they don't have as cost-effective system as we have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I mean, I know you don't want to take questions.
Well, why don't we get Mr. Edge to join us, who knows stuff about this. And you're welcome to hang in there, join us back, and either of you.
I'll keep Mr. Edge company.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Edge. I'm a DHS assistant director with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. Representative Kotek has explained the bill very well. This is a bill that would establish a new program in Medicaid. As she said, it's often referred to as the Chaffee program because it's named after a congressman who sponsored this. There are a number of other states who do this. It would simply allow adolescents in foster care, aging out of foster care at age 18, to continue to get Medicaid medical health care benefits up to through age 21. We recognize that adolescents aging out of the foster care program do sometimes have difficulty entering mainstream society, and this is a way that would at least allow them to continue to get health care benefits for a period of time to assist in that process. So in that sense, conceptually, the department is supportive of this program. It unfortunately does have a modest fiscal. Our calculation of the fiscal is that it would be 1.8 million general funds, the first biennium, or 1.3 million general funds, the first biennium, and 3.8 general funds, the second biennium.
I'm sorry, would you say again, please?
1.3 million general funds in the 2009-11 biennium, and 3.8 million general funds, the second biennium.
That's just what I guess.
Can I?
It's a good question. Yes, Representative Broom.
Mine is, once again, just trying to get a, I appreciate the financial estimate on that. I'm trying to get a better handle on how big the population we're talking about. I'm just making sure I understand your written testimony here. You say last year in Oregon, 387 children aged out of foster care. Is that our population, or is it a portion of that population? Because that seems low to me. How many kids are we talking
about? Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, excellent question. In any current, right now, our average, during the course of a year, about 12,000 children will be connected with the foster care system. We're talking about a subset of children who are essentially wards of the state,
yeah,
who are not adopted, who are not moving into a different family situation, and they are in foster care when they turn 18, and literally at 18 lose all services. And so it is a smaller population, and I believe last year we had I'd have to go look at the numbers, but it's a subpopulation of every child who's in foster care, because it wouldn't apply
to
everyone.
387 is just that, Mr. Chair.
Is that aging out?
It's 387 children who have aged out of foster care and do not have health insurance.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, it's the number of children who aged out of foster care.
Okay, so it's...
So it could be even smaller than that, like I said,
your next sentence says that a third of the children who age out do not have health insurance, which I imply is two thirds do somehow, somewhere.
Okay.
And I actually don't know the numbers for Oregon and what that would be, and I'd be curious to know how the department is. They're basing their estimate on something, so.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I don't know the numbers behind the dollar figures that I've just presented, but I do know that some of these adolescents who age out of the foster care program may move into a situation where they have private health insurance and they wouldn't necessarily need this benefit. Some of them may qualify for the Oregon Health Plan on their own merit without this program being in place. So it's a subset of this population that we're talking about.
And my only comment is, Mr. Giles, and I'll finish, is just that if it's, you know, if we're talking 350 to 400, even 500 kids a year, but it's even a subset of that population, then the fiscal that you're, and I realize we don't have a formal one, seems really, really high.
Well, the fiscal of $4,000 a year was the number she gave times 350 kids, turns into $5 million a year, which would be roughly a third of that. So it's the...
It still seems high.
But remember, we do get Medicaid match, though, but yeah.
No, it's $5 million total.
Mr. Chair, we're also...
That's where the... I mean, that seems to me...
That 387, though, that's the number of children aging out of the foster care system every year. This is covering children between the ages of 18 and 21, so it's within 3 years. You need to multiply that by three. So even if it's a subset, maybe it's half of those 357. You got to take that half multiplied by three. You're back up above 300. I mean, we don't know, but it's my guess is it's probably more than 387 children who, after a few years of this program, would be qualified.
Well, I did 1,000 kids at $4,000 a month to get $5 million.
Okay. Well, and Mr. Chair, and Representative, I think these are good questions, and I would want to. I would love us to see us move this bill and get a more accurate fiscal. I would actually say we should check in with a couple of the states who have similar age ranges covered in their waivers to see what their attrition, even by the age 21, whether those individuals still need coverage, and working with Mr. George from Child Welfare to try to come up with a better number. I'm not saying I just think there's a lot of variables we might want to look at the fiscal, because the things you're raising, I'm not sure, have been included in the fiscal. I don't know. I haven't seen the numbers. So.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of rules. If you expand to 100%, as we're trying to do now, I would guess half of those kids would come in other than the normal expansion.
And Mr. Chair, I think the important part of this is if you've reached 18 in the foster care system, you know that if you're not able to find coverage, you won't be dropped off. And I think that's the key there. And so trying to figure out how many that might be a little bit of a equation problem, but it's about that safety net of when someone leaves the program that they're at least covered, especially if they're in care right now. We want to have that continuity of care when they leave.
Okay. We're preparing some amendments on the Kids Connect piece. We can talk about this after. You might want to put this into that piece of the amendments that Cardi Black and Tom Burns are trying to work out, and cutting that section down as a possible amendment into 2009.
Mr. Chair, I'll put it anywhere that gets it funded.
Well, let's keep it in several places so we have all the options we need to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, do you have other testimony now?
That's it, Representative.
Thank you very much for being here. If you could, don't go away too quickly. Let me call Omar Gadi. Is that right? Come on. And Jamie Heise. Is that right? Is that an A or an N? Did I say it right? It's an N, and it's Heinz. Good. And then after that, we'll have three other folks, Jennifer McGowan, Terry Fennell, and Pamela Butler. So if you guys would start, introduce yourself to start, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't need both. My name is Jamie, and I was a former foster youth, and I'm 20. I currently attend the University of Oregon, and I firmly support this bill for a lot of reasons, actually, but I'm only going to talk about a couple. Mostly because as a youth in foster care, you're pretty much used to not having any money to your name, so usually going to college or post-secondary school, anything like that, looks really expensive, so you don't want to go. So having the support of health coverage would really help. Also, youth come into care without anything that has anything to do with medical care because of our family resources. And not all of our treatment is covered, and we're so used to having therapy and everything provided for us when you get into college, and there's nothing there. So not all of our colleges also offer financial aid. Like, packages don't offer to cover medical expenses. They don't offer to cover auto expenses or anything like that. It's just room and board. And so then you're forced to use the emergency room, and then you go into debt, and then it's just not pretty. Another reason is because I actually came down with mono right after I lost my health care, of course, and so I missed a lot of school, and now I'm behind in school, and I'm behind in finances because I have to pay for all of it. And I've risked losing my housing and my financial aid due to that, and I know a lot of other foster youth have had to go through that too. A lot of youth risk going off their meds once they have to leave foster care, and because they don't have money to pay for it, and they risk losing their counseling, and they don't have the family support like other teens. And so we're living off our financial aid, and that just doesn't cover everything. And that's just for students in students, you know, in college that were in foster care. I think that was all that I had, so I just ask that you firmly support the bill.
Well, thank you so much for being here, and I know we others join on congratulating you on getting to where you've gotten, and hope we can do everything we can to help you achieve over the kind of difficulties you clearly face. Any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do. What kind of health, not coverage, but health access do you have at the university?
We have a health center, so every time you get sick, you go there.
Okay. So you don't, and you're required? Is that part of your student fees, access to that student
health center? They charge it to your student bank account, and so okay. It's a debt that you have to end up paying through your financial aid when your financial aid back checks come through. Okay. But that's just the way the University of Oregon does it. The other universities don't have the same program. Okay. And so, and they offer university insurance, but it's way too expensive, or you can have your own private insurance company pay you back. If you bring in your receipt for your meds, and then they pay you back.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Gotti, hang on. Mr. Gotti, please.
Oh, okay. My name is Omar Nagani. I am a former foster youth or ward of the state, however you want to call it. I'm 23 now, and I guess you could say I represent some of the most privileged people who've left foster care. I left foster care with a 5-year scholarship to a university of my choice, and I chose Portland State University. I'm a little embarrassed to admit that during the second year of school, I almost had to drop out because I was having academic problems. In high school, I did really well. I got a 3.1 GPA, and on my SATs, I got a 12-something out of 1,600. So I was capable of getting into school, but after I was put on academic probation twice, I saw a specialist when I was 20. My scholarship paid for the medical services, fortunately, and I discovered that I had a learning disability. I have ADHD and/or ADD, and I was having difficulties concentrating and organizing assignments and all those things that you need to do in order to be successful in an academic setting. And if I didn't have that medical treatment, which a lot of students who are leaving foster care, if they're lucky to go into college, if I didn't have that, I probably wouldn't be successful, and I would have unfortunately had to drop out. And that would have been, you know, really, really, really sad. And after I left foster care when I was 18, I also needed counseling services. And even though I have some insurance as a student, my scholarship paid for a lot of my my counseling services, a scholarship that most students don't get, I might add. But I give testimony for this bill and hope, and I support it because, unfortunately, being in foster care is difficult, and a lot of people go into foster care for a variety of different reasons. Some children are taken away from their families because they're neglected, because they're physically abused, because they're even sexually abused, and they may develop or they may begin to develop psychological or medical problems outside of being 18, and it's important that I would recommend that you would give people coverage until they're 25, but I guess, you know, till 21 it's a good step in the, you know, it's a step in the right direction. But yeah, I do support this bill, and thank you for your time. And if you have any questions for me.
Any questions? I don't suppose it'll make you feel any better, but the sophomore year trips up a lot of us, and the end of my sophomore year, second semester, I ended up with 4 hours of D, 2 hours of C, and 9 hours of withdrawal.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not a good year for a lot of us. I'm glad you transcended it.
Well, thank you for that makes me feel better.
Didn't make me feel any better.
Yeah, the sophomore crunch, yeah.
There's one more ad, actually. You call him Dr. Greenlick, too. So
Dr. Greenlick.
Truncate his education too much.
Yeah, it started my education, I think. Yeah. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Can I call Jennifer McGowan, Terry Fennell, and Pamela Butler, please? Any order.
All right. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer McGowan. I'm a staff attorney from the Juvenile Rights Project. The Juvenile Rights Project has represented tens of thousands of children in foster care over the past 30 years, and I appreciate the testimony so far, especially from the young people whose stories, I think, really demonstrate for the committee the need for this bill. I'm here in support of House Bill 2728, because I believe it's an important effort to provide critical support for youth aging out of foster care. We know that this group of young people face all sorts of needs and all sorts of obstacles as they move out of foster care, and we've been instrumental in pushing public policy to help in that transition process. But one piece that has not yet been addressed is the medical coverage that's so desperately needed. In my written testimony, and I won't read it, but you can look at it and look at that overall studies are showing 54% of foster children had at least one psychiatric diagnosis compared to 19% of non-foster children. This was a study by the Oregon Health Plan. Also, Casey Family Foundation did a study of foster children in Washington and Oregon and found that foster children actually suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder at a rate nearly double that of U.S. war veterans. So we're talking about a population of kids who have faced trauma, abuse, and neglect, as you heard from one of the previous speakers. Also, foster care itself, for kids aging out of the foster care system, life is not always easy. They've been bounced from home to home. They may have moved from school to school. They haven't necessarily been able to find the stability that we're hoping the foster care system would offer, which would be return to family or adoption or other permanency. So once they're aging out, a lot of times they've spent multiple years in a foster care system that isn't always as supportive as we would hope. So we're talking about a population in great need, but again, as you heard from Representative Kotek, this is a small population of folks. You know, my written testimony talks about in 2007 there were, I think, 304 youth aging out of the foster care system. It usually is right around that 300 to 350 figure per year. This bill would cover them up until the age of 21 once they age out. So we're probably talking about a group of people, 19 and 20-year-olds usually. Our legal system does allow for youth to remain in foster care up until the age of 21, but that's not necessarily the norm across the state. It varies from county to county. A lot of our youth are leaving the system at 18 without a lot of family support or any family support and other support. So looking at trying to cut off any mental health support or physical health support is a real concern. One of the recent studies I saw showed that right before exiting foster care, 47% of the foster youth were accessing mental health services, and after they were exited from the foster care system, only 23% were still accessing those services. We know that that wasn't because they were no longer needed. It's because they were no longer available to them. And in terms of trying to move these young people forward that we have such a responsibility for, obviously that's not the way to help support them be productive citizens as they move forward in life. I think it's really important to mention again that this is there's a federal match involved in this. So we're not talking about just state general funds. It's taking advantage of the Chafee Act that was passed in 1999. I do know that the figures that Representative Kotek cited, the $350, I believe, that she cited per member per month, was on the high end of the states that I looked at. 17 states, at least, and I think there may be several more, have taken advantage of this waiver. And I know that California reports it's $150 per member per month, and then they vary in between $350 being the most expensive that I saw. I think that was out of South Dakota. So, you know, I think it's important to get a good handle on the fiscal and see where we're coming from. But obviously, we're talking about a small population of young people, but a population of great need and a population for which we have a lot of responsibility for, and this could be of great benefit to them. So I strongly urge you to support House Bill 2728. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions? Seems to me many of these kids will end up in the healthcare system, whether they're covered with a federal match or not. Okay. Thank you very much. Terry Fowle? Please.
Representative Chair Greenlick and committee, my name is Terry Fennell. I'm a foster parent, have been for the past 23 years. I've served about 700 teenage youth in my home over that time frame. Because I do take older teens, obviously they are aging out from my home, and so I get a chance to kind of see what does happen as they do age out. And I am definitely in support of this bill because many of the young people that are in my home do have medical needs with regard to meds that they are taking, right? Currently, I have 7 boys in my home, and 4 of them are on at least 2 psychotropics, and those are not inexpensive meds for the most part. And if they leave the system and have no way to replace those or have those meds be available to them, then the challenges that they will face will be significantly increased. And so I'm very concerned with them not having access to that medical services, and that's why I think this bill is so important. I do believe that, you know, basically these young people are the state's children, and it seems logical that the state does be supportive of them as they are transitioning into adulthood. My concern is that with some of these, especially with the medical needs that they have, that because of the fact they can stay in foster care up until they're age 21, that many may stay in if that's what their needs are, and then you're not only are you paying for the meds, but you're also paying me. And so I think that would also be a more costly expense, obviously, than just to provide them the medical needs that they need and allow them to go ahead and transition into the real world. So I definitely am supportive of the bill and hope that you consider passing this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fennell. Are there any questions? Ms. Butler?
All right. Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, my name is Pamela Butler. I'm here. I am a former foster youth as well, aged out of the system after 11 years at age 18 with no health care. At the time, I didn't think it's a problem because when you're young, you think, of course you're not going to get hurt. There's mm-hmm. nothing wrong. But I have severe asthma and also severe allergies that hospitalize me at least once a year, even when I have health care. So I went off to college and was lucky enough to get a scholarship with the Orphan Foundation of America. And when they found out I didn't have health care, they said that's unacceptable. And they actually paid my premiums every month for me to have health care while I was in school. And that was fantastic, but it was just for standard, the base health care. And I actually wasn't able to continue my counseling and mental health treatment. And I got to school, and for anyone leaving home, it's very difficult. When you leave foster care, it's even more difficult. Coming away with emotional stress, like she said, have higher rates of PTSD. I know firsthand that leaving care was, it was almost a culture shock going into a school, a public university, with all these kids coming from happy families, seeing all their, you know, them with their parents on campus, and you're the only one alone. And so just that whole culture shock of being surrounded by no one that you have anything in common with, and then having myself having severe anxiety, severe clinical depression, attempted suicides, was really, really emotionally unstable and needed that mental health. I mean, that if they could have just paid for my mental health stuff, I could have gone without the other part of the health care. But I strongly support this bill because I feel like as you leave care, that's the point when you need like some continuation in your medical provider, your doctor, your medications if you're on them the most is when you're leaving care. So to cut kids off at 18 and send them out, I actually know my sister, she was on quite a few medications in foster care. When she got out, she lost her meds, lost her health care, and turned to self-medication with drugs. And that's the route I've seen for quite a few kids coming out of care in her older group, which was a couple years older than me. So I support this bill. I think the foster kids are all of our kids, and I feel I am no longer in that category, but I will advocate till the end that the ones who age out now don't get left behind and fall through the cracks. So thank you. If you have any questions.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. Ms. Butler, you testified before and trying to place what committee and... What?
It was education.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Anyway, you represent yourself very well. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, I think we all admire the way you folks have overcome such severe barriers and hopefully are on your way to a better life. It's really quite extraordinary. It's very moving for us to hear these. We deal with budget numbers, $4 billion shortfall and all that stuff, but it's really important for us to be able to put a face behind those dollars and to say these are the kind of people that are out there that need our help. And I was sitting here thinking that as a parent, my kids went off to college and my health insurance plan allowed them to stay on until they were 23 because they were in college, and the extent to which the state is the parents of these kids, we have that same kind of obligation, it seems to me. I've been told it's best not to try and move the bill today until we get a fiscal light. My intention would be to get that by Friday and move it. It clearly needs to go to Ways and Means, so I don't think it makes much difference what the numbers are in the fiscal light. It's not going to say that we don't need to go to Ways and Means. And I'll also ask Representative Kotek to work with Ms. Black and Mr. Burns to try and put this into whatever we do with the Kids Connect piece of either 209 or the regular Kids Connect. But I think my sense is this does need to go to Ways and Means. It needs to be indicated that it's a priority for us to take this step. So I think you've made an important impact. Thank you for coming to talk to us today. And it's a really bad year, but we're going to do everything we can to especially to take care of our children.
Yes. Thanks.
Yeah, we're scheduling a work session on Friday. Since it's a carryover and we had a possible work session scheduled today, we can do that without any other announcements. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for bringing this to us, Representative Kotek. I'll close the public hearing on 2728. And ask if there's any other business to bring before us. This is a sobering end to the day for me. Yeah, we are going to try and hold the 14th. We're going to try and use that for a possible another joint meeting with the Senate if they can work with us. If enough of us are available here or by phone, I think we will try it. Tuesday night the 14th,
we have another possible night meeting.
Don't we work full days?
This would be from 6 to 9.
This would be from 6 to 9. We were trying to have a longer session. Okay. Some people said it was hard for them to come. And if we don't have all of us available to vote on 2009, either in person or by phone, then we won't plan on doing it. We'll plan on doing it on the 15th.
Mr. Chair, just one other thing you had also posted, I think, on 2009. I just wanted to mention the counties have been back in touch with me regarding Section 10 and the board authorized to undertake joint contracting for health care services on behalf of the public. And I think, you know, given that they often have multiple unions that have contracts written, we may need to do a little finessing of that language.
I think you need to look at the language as it comes to us in the filing. I don't think there's anything that
maybe
requires that to happen.
Well, that's what I was trying to read with this current language.
Is that in the place where it's the council, the public employee council, or is it in the one that gets the plan? Let's find out what it really says in the current form before we...
Yeah, and I could read that both ways, that it's mandatory and that they could make it an option. So I'm not quite sure.
I'm not sure the context in which that comes, but I do not believe there is anything in the current bill that requires all the counties and cities to become a part of a pool. There is a council that will include their representatives, and then there are some requirements for the board to plan for how the exchange works in this regard, but let's look at it.
Well, somebody would review that. I'd appreciate it. Thank you. Because that's my view, too.
You'll have the chance you'll have this little 625-page amendment, or 655-page amendment. We are adjourned early.